We love our children. We protect them. We guide them. We prepare them for life in the world. With all that we do, from deep in our hearts, we cannot control all things. Life-threatening illnesses and disabilities affect far too many of our children each year. While we cannot change the circumstance, we can make dreams come true. Dreams to provide hope, to provide spiritual healing and strength, to provide moments of happiness and relief in the hardest of times. We can give a glimmer of light and hope in a time of darkness and despair. Join huntofalifetime.org to help make dreams come true, to provide hope for children with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. Hunt of a Lifetime is a nonprofit organization fulfilling dreams for hunting and fishing trips to youth 21 and under with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. Visit huntofalifetime.org to learn how you can make a difference.
Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other Game Wardens on our adventures, protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experiences of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigation, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch.
Warden's Watch, episode 121. Best-selling, New York Times award-winning author C.J. Box with his all-new epic adventure that's going to be released February 27th, 3-inch teeth. John and I sit down with C.J. and have another conversation with him regarding his new book. And it's kind of a peek into, without giving away any secrets, a peek into the book and a great conversation between all three of us about wildlife, about interactions. I think if you listen to episode 118 with Roy Brown, and when he talks about those investigations into grizzly bear encounters, when people had to shoot grizzly bears and whether he had to determine whether it was justified or not, it's a great preview to what this book does and what Joe Pickett has to deal with in this upcoming book. It's just one of those epic adventures that only Joe Pickett can get into. And if you're a big fan of Joe Pickett, you're going to really like this. You're going to listen to CJ talk about the research he did on this book and how he wants to get everything right. It's just a great thing. Remember, when people want to hide from the law enforcement, they go to the woods. When they want to hide evidence, where else do you go to the woods? So these encounters that CJ writes about in these Joe Pickett novels are really happening. Maybe not to just one game warden, but collectively it's happening to us all. We're having these encounters. We're coming upon murders, evidence, all kinds of stuff out in the wilderness, the rural areas where we patrol. So sit back, enjoy this little peek into the new upcoming epic adventure book to be released February 27th, 2024. And thank you, CJ, for all you do to promote Game Wardens and our mission out there. And we really appreciate you making a book that's entertaining and the general public can enjoy. And it kind of gives them a kind of a feeling what Game Wardens do. Thank you. Enjoy this one.
Welcome back to the Warden's Watch podcast, and we are super excited again to have back number one New York Times best-selling author C.J. Box, Game Warden author of the Joe Pickett series, and we're going to be talking about his new book, 3-Inch Teeth, which is another epic adventure. And again, I was just saying this to these guys, I'm fascinated being an East Coast warden about West Coast animals, so things that I don't know, so I did some research after reading your book and stuff like that, measured my own bear skulls and stuff, CJ. But yeah, what, you know, What inspires you to do the way you go and when you do it? I mean, did something grab a hold of you and said, geez, let's focus on a grizzly?
Well, luckily, what didn't grab a hold of me was a grizzly, for sure. No, anybody you know who lives in the Mountain West right now, especially if you hunt, which I do, or even just get out into the wilderness, grizzly bears have there have been more and more grizzly bear encounters just about every year over the last 5 to 7 years. This past year, I've got to say there were probably fewer, and I'm not sure whether it was weather conditions or what. But in previous years, there have been more attacks, more encounters, as they call it. And what really fascinated me as I kind of dug into it was that, we've all heard the rules about, going into grizzly bear country, the safety measures to take bear spray or firearms, and that, not to do dumb things like walk between a sow and her cubs and have food available, those kind of things that might attract bears. But what's happened, not in every instance, but in an alarming number of instances, are attacks that would be considered almost unprovoked. Hunters, hikers, literally being attacked by grizzly bears, and no provocation could be found. And that's a pretty scary prospect, to think that bears, some bears, literally are, can hunt humans. And I spent a lot of time with game and fish officers in Wyoming, a couple of them who are on what they call the predator attack team, the first responders when there's a bear attack. And in a couple of instances, it was really that unprovoked attacks, bears just charging out of trees toward elk hunters who knocked an elk down and didn't stop. We could go on and on with some of these stories, but in one instance, around Teton County, a sow and her yearling cub killed a elk hunting guide. The hunter escaped, but the next day when the predator attack team arrived by helicopter, the bears attacked the helicopter and they had to kill him. And the wildlife people tried to figure out, was there something wrong with these bears? Did they have brain tumors that made them so aggressive? And in the end, they could not find a reason for that unprovoked attack. So I was fascinated by that. And there's more than one instance of that in Wyoming, Montana, of bears seemingly losing their fear of humans and attacking. And, when it's 350-pound animal with 3-inch teeth, that's a pretty scary prospect.
Hey, CJ, on that note... You're not far, this is a work of fiction, a great book, by the way, 3-inch teeth, lot going on in it. I don't want to give it all away yet, but from the standpoint of bear behavior in general, like we talked about before the show, being up in Northwest Montana, not far from you where you're at in Wyoming, this is a very common occurrence. It's not rare. I've had family members that have been bluff charged and almost had to put a sow down that she might've had cubs or not. And there's like this weird, 1% factor. We saw that in California. When I was a warden down there, we had to take black bears that had attacked scouts through their tents down in San Bernardino Mountains completely unprovoked. And it was just that weird one. Most bears won't do that, but these were deadly encounters. And then we are tasked with, as as game wardens, having to go out and neutralize those animals because we can't transplant and we can't take them anywhere else. They're going to be a problem. But getting to your book, when I read about the PAT, the Predator Attack Team, as you described it, kind of struck a nerve in me because we formed up the marijuana enforcement team, a tactical unit in California, to deal with the cartels and the environmental crimes, everything they would do. And I went, hey, this really makes sense, man. This really makes sense because, the lone Joe Pickett game warden that's out there, which, personifies every game warden that's out there by ourselves. If we have to deal with a grizzly attack in real time without a support unit, it's very dangerous. And I think in this book, man, you just captured that about how formidable these animals can be if they happen to be that, small percentage that go that aggressive and want to attack and kill.
Mm-hmm. Right. Along the same lines, same kind of one of the eeriest things I heard from the head of the predator attack team about the bears that attacked the elk hunting guide, killed him, and then attacked their helicopter when they arrived, is that they cut the head off the female bear and put it in the helicopter to take it down and have it analyzed. Mm-hmm. And they said it was most miserable helicopter ride because that bear was reeking of bear spray so badly that the pilot was had tears in his eyes.
Yeah.
Meaning the bear spray didn't work in this instance, which is scary too.
Yeah. Yeah. We've seen that in Montana a lot. You know, everyone hiking Glacier Park, getting their bear spray. A lot of people don't want to be armed. And I'm not saying we have to always have a firearm. That's the only solution. But I know when we're in bear country, whether we're from an enforcement capacity or hunting or fishing or hiking or high lakes, and you know how deadly they can be in your neck of the woods. You know, it might be a good idea to have that right firearm in the oh crap moment where you don't have any other options and that bear spray isn't working. We find in Montana, honestly, and I don't know if you saw this in your research, but it's about a 50-50 that this bear spray even works. Sometimes less, depending on weather, humidity, wind direction, and all those kind of things. And Wayne and I know from using pepper spray as officers, that can go awry really quick, man. You can contaminate yourself. And if
just like that pilot.
Good luck. You're just making yourself kind of marinated for that big boar sow coming at you.
That's right. And there's always the one or two people every year in Yellowstone Park who buy bear spray and then apply it like mosquito repellent on their skin and end up in the clinic. Yeah, so that's dangerous too.
Yeah, I remember my first hike in Alaska with friends there, and they were like, we're going off to an old gold mine, and the arsenal that they were carrying, you know, I was like, are you guys serious? You know, and they're like, oh yeah, we're serious. And we happened to see a brown bear on the next ridge over, and I was like, yeah, I can see why you're serious, but everywhere you go in the woods there, you carry a gun and a heavy gun to try to stop that threat if it occurs. And when they hunt there, they you know, my buddy would harvest his blacktail so quickly. He's like, you're more worried about skinning that deer out, getting it in your pack, and your head's on a swivel the whole time because the bear hears that shot and that's the dinner bell coming. So he's like, exactly. You got to be pretty dang efficient to get these things and get those out and keep your eyes open for that bear. So he's like, it's a very stressful situation.
Right. And I think one thing I tried to, you know, at least address somewhat in the book is something I heard from several of the predator attack team and a guy named Dan Thompson, he's a PhD in Wyoming, but he's on the predator attack team, but he's also he's the supervisor of large carnivore encounters in Wyoming. And he's really knowledgeable, really fun to talk to. And one of the issues he talked about, bears, yes, but also, you know, I like to always kind of address some of the ethical issues about wildlife management and just living in the West. And the fact that every time they go after a problem bear or try to move a bear, what you're talking about, they get pushback from certain factions and activists who somewhat kind of, what's the word, anthropomorphize the bears and want to protect the bears under any circumstances and criticize the wildlife enforcement officers for even dealing with them. So that's another one of those things that it seems like common sense, but there's always that other point of view.
There really is, CJ, and that's a great point. And we see that with all the big deadly predators, right? In California, it's the California mountain lion, where I spent most of my career dealing with problem mountain lions, whether it was depredation issues with our cattle ranchers or pets and things like that on those, you know, those urban transition areas, or just a flat out public safety attack. And we had some attacks, and you know, I had a couple instances where I had to basically neutralize four cats throughout my career, and three of them were public safety cats. And that's in the San Jose Bay Area, the Silicon Valley. So you can imagine the sentiment you're going to get from press responses. And even our rural game wardens in, you know, parts of Wyoming on the fringes of towns like where you're at. I see it with my Montana brothers up there, what they're dealing with, that sentiment toward the predator. Like, how can you kill it? They're rare. They're endangered. You know, can't you just relocate it? And it's, I know I'm kind of preaching to the choir of the three of us, but there's that delicate balance in the conservation model where these predators, when protected to a certain point, get so abundant. And now everything's kind of in jeopardy of going out of balance. And it's a hard thing to convince people who, you know, have that sentiment, which we all love wildlife. We just see it through a different lens, knowing the management concept of it. But on the predator attack team, when you were researching that, I'd never heard of that before, and I know several Wyoming guys. We've just never discussed it. they had that team for a long time, and it seems like something a lot of states could benefit from that are having this problem. I know in California we have a mountain lion response team, but it's not as, I think, deliberate and capable of going out really quickly and making that decision like with a grizzly bear, where there's no other option. We're going to hunt this thing tactically because it's going to kill somebody else or potentially do that. Very fascinated to hear about that and what your thoughts were on this becoming something other departments can benefit from as more and more people travel about the outdoors and run into predators.
Wow, that's a great question and topic. I never have not given that a lot of thought. I know that the Predator Attack Team is at least 6 years old, because the first time I talked to a member of it was about then. And that was not long after that elk hunting guide was killed. And this guy was the first guy on the scene. So they've been around, I would guess, in Wyoming, maybe 6 or 7 years. Probably, you know, I'm speculating, but simply in response to more fatal attacks than before, that it's an organized way to assemble. I mean, it's like a SWAT team. I mean, some of them wear body armor. They have 308 semi-automatic rifles. They drop by helicopter, and they try to do it as quickly as possible before the bear gets away, or bear, or, you know, wolf, or whatever it is. You know, whenever I don't think they're called out very often, but when they are, it's usually a really grave situation.
Yeah, and I would imagine they've got to be mobile, rather chopper, whatever, because you guys don't have a lot of game wardens in Wyoming as a whole. You're not a large game warden state, nor are we in Montana, compared to like my old state of California where I did my career. But getting those guys together effectively, that's no easy feat. So they put a lot of time and thought, I'm sure, into this team. And if it's 6 years old, it's relatively new to the problem that's morphing, it sounds like, throughout not only your state, but other states, including my home state as well. So it's a really interesting development. Not a lot of people are going to know about till they read your new book. Mm. And it's really cool that you, you know, you went into that world of, wow, this is a real thing, you know, and this is something we really need to address. And it's going to create a lot of that discussion and controversy of, do you kill every bear that's a public safety threat? Do you try to rehab and relocate? Really good stuff there. So it'll be interesting to see.
Thank you.
The feedback we get and what we hear as we promote your book and what you hear on the road, and be good to talk with you about that.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I'm curious too. I'm always curious to see how, you know, some of the responses on that. You know, one thing, I mean, honestly, having talked to a couple of people who are on the Predator Attack Team and the large carnivore specialists, and like you, I'm sure both of you, no one wants to kill bears. Oh, they don't go out to kill bears. They're not hunting bears. They're just responding to an incident where there's probably no other choice. I mean, these guys are not gung-ho, how many bears have you killed kind of thing at all. They would rather deal with bears in a different way, but sometimes it's just, when a bear attacks a helicopter, what do you do?
Mm-hmm. You're kind of back against the cliff on that one, yeah.
And that was, you know, the book opens up with and I'm not, just no spoilers here because it's in the, all the publicity material. Open a guy fly fishing in the middle of a river, and a bear charges out of the woods down a slope and gets him on the water. And that was one thing when I talked to the bear experts, I said, you know, is that too far fetched that a fisherman would get it like that? And he said, well, let me send you a YouTube video of a bear swimming after a drift boat on the Snake River last year, trying to get it, and they're hitting it with oars. I said, okay, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, almost anything you can conceive of has happened or an example of it. So as far-fetched as some of the things may sound, especially in this book, since there's several other things going on, as you know, that are not inconceivable.
Right. Very timely, well, too.
It's 100% authentic that it can happen. We fish the Kootenai out my front door and fly fish the Kootenai River all the time in good conditions. And you're a fly fisherman as well. Wayne is as well. And we've had that same thing with not only the grizzlies, but the black bears. When it's berry season and they're down in early spring, we're having constant encounters with our drift boats, with our shore fishermen, and we never go unarmed. So without a spoiler alert, because the opening story was so gripping, especially because of who the young man was, his relationship to our to Joe, and I don't want to give it all away, but what he was carrying as far as a weapon and having a weapon ready for something like that is, it's an absolute for us. if you aren't armed on our river when you're fly fishing, you're asking, you know, you're asking to be a drive-through snack. You're just putting yourself in that position. Mm-hmm. But I think you set it up beautifully, and it really is heart-wrenching when you dive further into who he is, the relationship, and then it spirals from there. And it's, I can honestly say, living in country like that and seeing it firsthand, that is, that's as close to truth that this fiction book is. So there shouldn't be any naysayers there, I would hope.
Thank you. The particular scene on the river is a stretch of the North Platte River that I am lucky enough to fish. It's on a private ranch. Nice. And I go with the rancher and we go down there around that bend. And after I wrote that scene, I sent him that first chapter and he said he didn't feel like he could go fishing anymore.
I can understand that.
So I ruined it for him.
Yeah, for sure. Very timely too. Roy Brown, who's a retired U.S. Fish and Wildlife special agent in Wyoming. So we just interviewed him for just, I think, the teen, so episode 118. So just a couple back, and his primary job, CJ, was investigating grizzly attacks and whether they were justified or not when he was in Wyoming as a special agent. So, and he's got some unnerving stories similar to what you're describing, even in bear investigations when hunters had to engage him and shoot them and things like that. But that was his primary job in Wyoming, is bear encounters and seeing if they were justified or not. And what a call to make. That's pretty tough on responsibility on a special agent to determine that and whether it's justified or not.
Yeah, it is. I've not heard of him, but that's fascinating. If you read the case reports of some of these encounters or fatalities, again, going back to the particular one where the elk guide was killed, you know, what they found on the scene was, you know, a 10 millimeter Glock that was tossed aside because the hunter didn't know how to operate it to shoot the bear that was attacking the guide, and a can of bear spray that was completely expended on the scene. So it kind of told the story of what happened. The other weird thing about that particular one, when you talk about what bears do and their normal behavior and so on, is that these two bears didn't cache the body or feed on it. They just stood over it like they were guarding it until the helicopter arrived, which is also very uncharacteristic,
very
bear behavior.
No, very, very interesting. And black bears are very similar animals and similar stuff, I think. So, and having had to dispatch, I don't even want to count how many ones they have to.
No, that's right, Wayne.
Once they break into a house, they know that's where the food is, so they become housebreakers.
Right.
We investigated one. It would look like a murder scene in the kitchen. It was a 200-pound black bear, blood everywhere where he had broken in. The guy thought someone broke into his house, so he came down with his gun and encountered in his face a black bear in his kitchen, and emptied out a magazine. It was a .45, but it was a murder scene. It was blood everywhere, and the poor guy was so shaken up. I mean, it was unbelievable.
I can imagine.
Yeah, so those kind of, and that's kind of what you describe is that point blank, and we get that a lot from encounters with bears, is that point blank surprise reaction type of events.
Even if you are armed or and have bear spray, some of the attacks are so sudden that often, you know, there's really not much can be done.
Something else, and I don't think this is a spoiler, but you have a lot of different bear quotes all through this new book, which I enjoyed. I really, as a matter of fact, I perused them this morning, just the quotes again. And I was just, so many, the research on the quotes and the timeliness of them through the book and the different sources. I really enjoyed those, CJ.
Thank you. I work hard on those and sometimes have to really fight for them to get it,
really?
To get them included in the books, because copyright laws, rights of who wrote it, the family, the estate. Luckily, I was able to secure the rights to all of those quotes, even though they're sometimes widely, I can find them all over the internet, but
they
still do belong to somebody. But what really struck me about a lot of those quotes is how bears play such a huge role in the mythology, not only the U.S., but around the world. People ascribe a lot of attributes and mythological powers to bears, that I suppose I shouldn't have been surprised by, but I kind of was, you know, whether bears are good or bad or, you know, children of nature and that shouldn't be disturbed kind of thing. I mean, it's interesting to read those quotes, you know, kind of through literary history.
Yeah, they were really spot on, Bud. And getting back to what you said about the Predator Attack Team guys not going out as gung-ho ever wanting to have, we don't ever want to have to harvest a bear or kill a bear under those circumstances. I mean, all three of us as conservationists and hunters on this conversation and every game warden I know, that's the last thing you want to do. And I know from those lions I talked about that I had to deal with, that was gut-wrenching to see a predator cornered with no other options, whether they're injured, whether in an urban environment,
sure,
whether they've attacked. That's not the way we take animals as ethical, responsible, respectful hunters. And you mentioned the bear, almost, you know, with the myth to the bear and everything from the standpoint of the respect historically through Native American tribes, all that. They're a very unique predator, and they're a very necessary predator, whether they're black, brown, polar, whatever the case may be. But they're also dangerous, like we talked about. Brown bear hunters that go and target brown bears, the Fognak, Kodiak Island, hunts like that, know how dangerous that can be, and that's a delicate, delicate process. And you better be respectful and prepared if you're going to go out and try to harvest a bear that big effectively, humanely, and quickly.
Right.
There's that distinct difference. And I think you really get to that in the book. And it's something I've been fascinated with as a bear hunter, both a sport hunter and then having to deal with them like Wayne did in his state from the depredation public safety. And this book brings up a lot of controversial emotional topics, and especially for non-hunters that are going to read it. And I think they're going to resonate. I know I'm going to put it in the hands of a lot of folks that know what we do on the depredation front. With other animals and bear control up there, and some Montana game wardens as well, if they're not already reading your stuff, which most of them are,
good,
they got to read this book. Something you mentioned too that you touched on right in the beginning of the book that Joe was dealing with was the corner crossing,
yeah,
issue on the private public land. That
that's
could
right.
not have been more spot on, but with all the issues Wayne and I have talked about with other guests, that's the hot topic with my friends over at Meat Eater, with Steven and Yanni. They're constantly talking about it. There's court cases going on. What brought that about? What got you there to include that in this book? Because I thought it was spot on.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, I suppose I don't need to explain it to your audience. They kind of understand it. But the epicenter of that suit is less than 20 miles away from where I live.
Wow.
So, you know, I know the rancher who wants to keep the public out, and I know the ranch foreman who encountered the hunters who did the corner crossing. And my wife was even called on the jury, the original jury. But she,
oh,
she got the boot. She got the boot because she knew him too. So it's very, very local issue that has now, you know, become a huge thing across the West. And, you know, I've had so many, not arguments, but talks with people on both sides of the issue where I live. I can see both sides. And
right.
I think the only way that the dispute is going to be figured out is going to be in court at some level.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's going to be big losers on one side or the other once it's finally decided. But it's so unique, and so unique to the Mountain West, especially with the checkerboarded public land. But it's a thing, you know. And so, yeah, I try to kind of keep current on that kind of stuff and mention it. It's fascinating sometimes when I on a book tour, when I especially when I go to the East, where there's very little public land, and there's certainly not this
right.
goofy checkerboard thing.
Yeah.
Sometimes I spend as much time explaining these kind of issues in the West as I do talking about the book itself,
right?
Because it's foreign. And why should they know about it? It's weird. But Wyoming is almost 50% public land, so
yeah.
You know that's a big issue here.
Mm.
And it's interesting because it's just gonna grow as a problem, right? As we have more people migrating from the urban states, going to Montana where we're at, going to Wyoming where you're at, Idaho, finding that little spread post COVID, everybody trying to, you know, just get a little bit of space. And that's creating these checkerboards in much larger spaces, because it's never been a bigger issue in Montana, especially in the very remote northwest part of the state I'm in, but throughout the rest of the state, and for you in Wyoming as well. And Wayne, you've been dealing with it. We talked about that with the other guys from Northwoods Law. Even in the smaller states with your remote areas that you've got, it just seems to be growing with that urbanization. So It's going to be really interesting to see where this court case settles out. And like you said, CJ, there's going to be a big loss or a big win, but at some point there's got to be resolved, because this is one of those new, you know, duties as assigned game wardens are dealing with in every state. And we're just dealing with it more and more, and it's becoming more and more of a challenge for sure.
And as to specifically for game wardens, I think maybe there was legislation in the Wyoming legislature last year, but up until then, if a game warden was actually called on the scene of a corner crossing incident, the game warden had no authority to arrest the corner crossers unless they violated a law, a game and fish law.
Right.
Game wardens aren't out there to arrest trespassers in Wyoming. But I think there was some kind of provision that was maybe passed where they could at least become more involved with it. But I couldn't give you the specifics on that. But that's an ethical dilemma right there, where rancher calls the game warden. The game warden says, I can do nothing.
Right.
Got to call the sheriff.
Mm.
Yeah. Tough situation all the way around, no matter how you hack it. So.
And sometimes those are good things, too. It's kind of a hands-off thing. Hey, I can't handle this, so we'll call the sheriff for you on that. But those things seem to get addressed with legislators. When I came on, New Hampshire didn't have motor vehicle powers. And I lost, I held a guy for a trooper, for a DWI, for longer than the judge thought I should. And this guy was stumbling down drunk. I mean, really bad. I mean, so by the time he got there, the judge thought I held him for too long and didn't have the authority to do that, so he kicked it. Well, soon after that, all of a sudden, there's legislation for us to get, the authority to handle DWIs, which, again, is a double-edged sword, because that's not our focus, that's not what we like to do, but as we come across it, we can address it. So those were some of the issues that I think legislators see and say, hey, we got a law enforcement officer sworn by the state and they don't have the authority to deal with that. So yeah, it's crazy, but thanks for addressing those types of things. Very timely, very relevant, and it makes it so much more interesting, I think, to put those things in. And just even the fact of the predators coming into areas that haven't had seen predators in years, the expansion of black bears in the East Coast, the expansion of wolves and grizzly bears, and the more human wild animal interactions that we're going to experience, I think we're just starting to see what's coming in the future and how we as the modern day humans are going to start dealing with that.
I agree. I did want to touch on one thing that I think when John was talking about, when we were talking about the mythology of bears and how they're put in it, I think part of that weirdness comes from fact, and I have a scene in the book like this, and it's something I experienced myself, was walking into an elk camp as a young boy and seeing a black bear hung from the tree, skinned, and just being jarred how much it looked like a human person. A very heavily, looked like Jason Kelsey hung by his heels in that elk camp. And that chilled me to the core. And I think that's part of the weird mythology is that bears, when they're skinned and hung, look like very well-muscled men, people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a little different than other predators too.
It's a unique, very vast difference, like you said, CJ. And I remember when the movie Predator dropped way back when I was a teenager, before ever becoming a game warden. And you had the premise of that movie of these advanced alien intergalactic predators going on a trophy hunt to find the most dangerous humans. And when they skin some of those green berets, and how the imagery of that, I remember that burned in my head as a teenager. And then not seeing a hung bear until I was a game warden, going, oh my gosh, this looks like a man that these guys just murdered. This is like a scene out of Predator. So there's a whole different vibe when you're talking about bear hunting, when you're talking about bear poaching as well. I mean, we had the Hog and Dog. We had some crazy bear poaching things that happened in California as an example, and how you know, savage some of these bears were treated for dog training purposes. And this is not the ethical houndsmen that do it by the numbers. And there's some great guys out there. These are the dark side. That's where people resonate so much with bears and having that sympathy, is that human connection and that appearance. And it's eerie. It really is eerie, you know, when you look at it. But I'm going back to when we talked last time on our first great conversation with you, talking about the TV series. Mm-hmm. The first season had just wrapped up. It was well-received, a hit. It was so good to see it on the big screen. Some more people got that Joe Pickett game word message. We were so happy to see that. Mm. And then season two was filmed, but it had not dropped yet. And we had talked to you about, okay, season two is going to drop. No spoilers. We couldn't talk about it. And then we just watched season two, another fantastic season. And unfortunately, Paramount did not continue with additional seasons of Joe Pickett series. And I remember you put up a post, and I think I might have commented on it on social media, of, hey, this show should keep going. Mm. Can another network take it on? Which, you know, other networks like Amazon have taken shows, were amazing, and all of a sudden they blew them up to 3-4 more seasons. So how's that going, and what are your thoughts are on that? I mean, it's hopefully we see it come back. At least we got two seasons of what I consider, I think, the only scripted Game Warden series that's ever been out. So, that's a win if we never get anything back, but it would be nice to see it come back. And just curious where you're at on that as an executive producer, because you had a big part of that show besides just putting the literary content.
Well, actually, I didn't do that much. As an executive producer, you don't do much other than cash the check. That's about it. Provide the source material and cash the check. But no, it's kind of complicated. The show was popular. Was one of the highest rated. It was the third highest rated drama on Paramount Plus. But the problem was, I didn't know this till later, they didn't own the show. It was actually commissioned by Charter Spectrum for their cable subscribers. And then Charter got rid of their originals department. So Paramount Plus had the rights to do the streaming rights, but not the show itself. Gotcha. So it got complicated in the ownership of it. The real producers are attempting to shop it to other streamers right now. Nice. They said after the first of the year, they would start approaching them. I hope they do, of course. I know that what their plans are for the season three, and they're really good, and I think they've done a really good job with the first two seasons. So, fingers crossed. But it wasn't a viewership thing. It was an ownership thing. And entertainment is so stinking complicated as a business on who owns what and so on. And that was the problem.
Yeah. Very similar to the Northwoods Law and the Wild Justice, all those programs. We had Ben Shank, who was a producer on those shows, and basically said, television is changing, streaming is taking over, and these shows are going by the wayside. Again, not a viewership issue, but an ownership issue, as in they're changing gears.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very interesting.
Like I said, fingers crossed. I don't know when, at what point we say, okay, we tried, it's not good, it's not going to be on again. But they just now started to shop it around.
Mm. Yeah. And one of the cool things is that writer's strike and the Screen Actors Guild strike went on for, 10 months? And everything was at a standstill with projects we're working on down there. And now the floodgates have opened in the last 2 months, give or take. And these streamers are looking for content. So and that's a little, shot of adrenaline to say, hey, man, look back at this Joe Pickett series. We have a crew ready to go. Because it'll be immensely popular, and it needs to keep going. So we're crossing fingers.
100%.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's another way to tell the Game Warden story, and we are so appreciative that you're doing that in book form, for sure, CJ. It's just, it needs to get out there. We need to reach different people, and it has to be a constant message of what conservation is, and to reach those people. We were honored to have Mustafa Speaks on here, for sure.
Cool.
Yeah, it was very cool. John was able to line him up, and we had him on the show, and what an inspiring individual he was.
I agree. Yeah. I got to spend time with him on the set, and he impressed the heck out of me. Mm. And he was just, it was so fun too, because they had just shot the scenes where he, as a falconer, Nate Romanowski, had had gathered up the ducks, and then a drift boat comes by and he has a big gunfight with them. And he loved that stuff.
I can see that.
Who wouldn't?
Yeah. And something Mustafa said that just came across in that character. And I think from the TV series, if you haven't read one of your novels and you're watching Joe Pickett, the series, Cold, Nate next to Joe, I think is the most complex, eccentric, and interesting character because of his background, his special forces thing. I mean, the Falconer thing. And then he's on the run, but he's Joe's only real ally. And they're completely, polar opposites in a way of what their pasts are. And Mustafa conveyed to us, and it was a fantastic conversation where he said, that character just resonated with me as a man, and even though, and his background in marine biology and the work he had done with sharks, I didn't know anything about him other as an actor until we got to know
him.
So he too is like, yeah, let's get this back, man. I think that was one of his most, if not most enjoyable characters he's played. He's played a lot of cool characters on other shows, but that one hits him as a conservationist. So let's get this thing back on track, right?
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah. No, very cool. And certainly we look forward to maybe having some other actors on our podcast talking about that as well. So maybe down the road we can line something up. But certainly he said he would come back and talk to us too. So Mustafa Speak was very inspirational and... Yeah, just an inspirational guy. I really enjoyed the sitting down talk with him. So it's good to see that type of person as an actor, and see the backstory and get to know them a little. Like you just said, on the set, getting to know him. That's a pretty awesome place. So very cool. Anything else we want to throw in there, CJ? I mean, we've hit on a ton of topics all the way across conservation.
I don't know. I never set out to say... I joke sometimes when I'm doing talks and say, I knew the world was always waiting for a Wyoming game warden mystery series, and I'm the only guy who could do it. That's not true at all. I'm still always amazed how well the books do and how they're received.
Yeah.
The last Stormwatch, the book that came out last year, was the first one of mine to be number one across the board. Number one in best fiction and ebook and fiction, and it hung in there for like 6 weeks. So they resonate with a lot of people who aren't outdoors people at all, and across the entire U.S. and around the world. And that always just surprises me. I've got great hopes for this new one because I think, like we were talking about, bears have a certain connection to people that they might pick it up. So we'll see, but I've got high hopes.
Yeah, we've talked about it before. The family atmosphere that you draw is really a reality within the game warden family net. We are all, my wife answers calls.
Mm-hmm.
Our kids, they could be playing with a fawn that we brought home for the night or something before it gets to somewhere else. You really inspire that, and we talked about a lot of women reading you, and I think it has that family net, the wildlife interaction, the stories that we don't see so much. Westerns were a huge hit, and it brings that feeling back of the whole American dream, so to speak, whether it's from going out on the prairie, and it inspires me too, just to see the things and the intricacies that I pick up that you pick up from other game wardens. There's no doubt that you have some somebody helping you out with the technical stuff, because I'm like, well, that's funny that you do that on the radio, and they cover that up because of the lights at night and things that, we do as game wardens that maybe people read over, but I see those little technical things that you put in your books that game wardens do. So it's really cool, and I can see why it is number one for sure. And I got to believe this is going to be number one. But what worries me is, me and John are really similar age, 54, and Joe's getting up there. He's 51 at this point,
that's right?
Yeah, he's starting to feel his wares a little bit.
Yeah.
That's right. When he climbs off a horse, he hurts.
Mm.
Saddle sore and half the ride distance.
I could relate.
Yeah, that's right. But it's been fun and challenging to... And in fact, age the characters in real time throughout the entire series. I mean, I'm working right now on book number 25.
Wow.
Yeah, and, everybody's generally, not every book is a year past the last one. Some are adjoining it. This one is butted right up against Three Inch Teeth, starts almost immediately afterwards. But, you know, to age the characters and try to be realistic about that. And the kids have grown up and gone on different lives. And Joe and Mary Beth are empty nesters once again, although not necessarily. I won't tell you. I don't know if you read the
book. What sentence?
That's fun to do, is to develop their characters, you know, as they age.
No, it's nice.
One thing I want to pony on what Wayne just said is the technical accuracy in your books when it comes to representing tactics, equipment, and just solid game warden tactics. And this gets into first responder, military. It kind of transcends in that. And something in my own writing I'm very careful to do. And what I really admire in authors like yourself, rather than nonfiction, fiction, and screenwriters especially, like a Taylor Sheridan who gets it right tactically or through rather whatever venue, whatever medium is. So we're represented in the most professional light that game wardens can be for the job they do or any first responder. And when you talked about that shotgun being prepared with buckshot slug, slug.
Yes.
That is the mainstay way we go into bear country, either as enforcement to take out a problem bear, or when I'm hiking into a high lake for cutthroat, some days I have to take that shotgun because it's so potentially full of bears. And my locals will say, oh, you're going up there? Don't just take that handgun, man. You better lug that big shotgun. Like, ah, things so heavy. I got on my flight here. You know, but that was just great to see. And that lends something to your audience to see how formidable this predator is. And the fact that so many non-hunters are enjoying your books is absolutely kudos for that. Because I don't think there's any better way to get the balanced conservation message out and show that sometimes we have to do violent things and kill animals, unfortunately, for the sake of the balance of species in general and just for public safety and to keep everything in this delicate balance as we grow in population as humans. And you really put that out, and the TV series did that too. So the more we can spread your books, man, I hope they're number one in every category on Three Inch Teeth, because that one gets into conservation so specifically. And when is the book going to be available? What formats? What's the launch? How can people get it so all our listeners can be ready to jump on this thing?
February 27th is the official publication date.
Awesome.
It'll be available in every format, you know, hardcover, audio, ebook, everything. So, you know, it can be pre-ordered now, which we always encourage. And then I'm, you know, as usual, this going on a book tour immediately with that. And so I'm not going to the East Coast this time at all, but a lot of venues in the West and West Coast. So people can look at my website, which is cjbox.net. It lists all the appearances, and also can order the book on there.
Awesome. Awesome. We're looking forward to that. See you on the book tour.
Great. Thank you for joining us, CJ. New York Times bestseller, author, CJ Box, the Joe Pickett series, all new book, Three Inch Teeth. And I guess I want to just wrap up with one of those quotes out of your book, because I really enjoyed those. So, and it's from Edward Abbey. Are people more important than the grizzly bear? Only from the point of view of some people. Read this book and you'll understand. Thanks again, CJ, for joining us.
Thanks so much, man.
Thank you. This is always fun.
Yeah. Great, great conversation. We appreciate
it. It's even light out right now. I can see that sign. So that's good.
Awesome. Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other game wardens on our adventures, protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experiences of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigation, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden,
Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch.